You are tuned in to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, BC.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, Winnipeg CKUW and CJUM, Met Radio in Toronto, CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia, and featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network has become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we talk with Vancouver Socialist City Councillor Sean Orr about the complexities of balancing grassroots movements with electoral politics on the Beebsy Please. Unpack the story of a Canadian Armed Forces member's extremist Facebook group on the North State. Reveal the history of oil pipeline development on Sierra Club's The Environment in Canada. And explore populist right-wing exploitation of economic inequality in Quebec on Free City Radio. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged, launched in 2023 as a response to Meta's Canadian news ban. Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, the MB Media Co-op in Moncton, The Independent in St. John's, plus national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 23 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at unrigged.ca. And broadcasting since September 2020, Habibti Please features activist and academic Nashua Lina Khan exploring politics, pop culture, and more from an internationalist and Canadian perspective. On this week's episode, she sits down with Vancouver Socialist City Councillor Sean Orr to talk about politics, activism, and the complexities of balancing grassroots movements with electoral politics. Now, here's the show.
Hi, Habibtis. Welcome to a great conversation with newly elected Coalition of Progressive Electors Vancouver City Councillor, also known as COPE, Sean Orr. And I think you're going to love this episode. For more than two decades, Sean's been one of Vancouver's sharpest and most uncompromising voices, blending biting political commentary with deep-rooted community activism. From fronting punk bands to writing the long-running Tea and Two Slices column on scatmagazine.ca, a Vancouver community website, Sean consistently uses culture and critique to spotlight the inequities shaping his city, whether it's the housing crisis, police violence, or colonialism. His recent landslide election win marks not just a shift in local Vancouver politics, but also a growing demand for voices willing to speak plainly about injustice. On this episode, we talk about his journey through art, activism, politics, and his views on solidarity movements like Palestine, and what it means to hold radical commitments while working inside a limited political system. I really love this conversation. It felt honest, thoughtful, and full of the kind of political clarity we need much more of right now. I hope you all enjoy it as much as I did. Hi, everyone. Today, Sean Orr is joining us from Vancouver. Hi, Sean. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining today. And you've worn so many hats. I read that you've been a musician, a writer, an activist, and now you're a city councillor. How do you describe what you do and what ties these different roles together?
In terms of being a musician and a front man, you know, putting yourself out there, I think is part of it. Being an activist, you put yourself on the front lines. Being a blogger, you're putting yourself out there, social media. All that kind of thing is just sort of this almost in preparation for the kind of massive amount of attention that you inevitably get when you either seek public office or, in my case, win it. And you start to see all the scrutiny and but also just dealing with people as well. It kind of, especially the music part, really prepares you for that. But then just having a sort of, you know, in terms of your activism, it just gives you a solid base and a solid background to fall on, you know, knowing that you have these convictions and that you're here for a reason. Because, you know, being in office, I'm sure you've touched on this in your podcast, you know, it's just one part of the greater struggle, and it's probably a very small part, especially at the city council level. There's not a lot of power. There's not a lot of things that we can do to achieve, you know, sort of the large scale lasting change that we really want to see in the world. So it's kind of that kind of struggle of learning to balance when you can be most effective and learning when and where to try and push those buttons for sure.
Yeah. And looking back at what first pulled you into political writing, activism, and then kind of bridged you and scaffolded you now into this role as a city councilor, was there a moment that sparked this influence or something that like kind of drove this journey?
I wouldn't say there's any one moment. I mean, when you become sort of radicalized, you know, it's a sort of this, a series of steps, you know, like, I think being sort of adjacent to what was called the Wood Squat in Vancouver, downtown Vancouver, and seeing that and seeing the police response and seeing the media villainize homeless people and sort of, and then seeing what happened out of that, which was a condo development, you know, which a lot of activists were unhappy about, you know, that was kind of a bit of a start for me. And I was around Adbusters at the time and kind of, you know, a young activist and student and just trying to, you know, like figure things out. But yeah, it just piles up, you know, I've been living next to the downtown east side since 2007. So seeing, you know, the constant criminalization of homeless people, you know, seeing your neighbors, you know, villainized and marginalized and picked on and seeing them just not there all of a sudden, seeing so many people die. You know, that kind of builds up. Of course, 2016, when a lot of, you know, people were kind of, you know, radicalized during the first Trump administration and you know, the lead up to that and Black Lives Matter, just all these different things. I don't think I can really pinpoint one particular instance. And it even goes back to like my upbringing. My family comes from Northern Ireland, you know, a place where we're seeing, you know, colonial sectarian violence and civil war, and they left there and they didn't want anything to do with it, even though you know they had family ties to the colonizing side, to the Union side, and they don't want anything to do with that, and they wanted to start over in Canada like so many people. And they just raised me to sort of, you know, have this kind of fierce humanism and this kind of outlook where we just protect everyone. You know, my dad would march in solidarity with Catholics, you know, in the 60s in Londonderry. You see some of the colonialism still is in there, right? It's slash city. So, but I was always sort of just taught to kind of to have that outlook. And even my name was a bit of a protest. So my name is Sean Michael, two very Catholic names. It's almost like a protest against his Protestant father. So, yeah, it's hard to pinpoint one time for sure.
Some of your work that I've seen, and I'm going to link some of your old writing actually in the show notes, has spotlighted contradictions and inequalities of urban life in Vancouver. And I'd say issues like housing, poverty, gentrification, colonialism, like you said, like that frame of like those are your neighbors. Those are your neighbors. And how has the city itself shaped your politics and your creative work and the role you have now?
Yeah, that's, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. It is a city of contradictions because it is such a beautiful city. And there's so much wealth here, but the inequality is what just doesn't add up, right? Like you can go to one area and you just kind of forget, and then you come back home and you're just like, oh, right. There's this whole thing, and it's just this kind of constant mind f- essentially that you're just kind of negotiating all the time, right? You know, because it is so beautiful. And like I think I forget her name, but the UN special rapporteur called Vancouver an apartheid city, and I really think, you know, that's quite accurate. And it's interesting. My mom's a historian, so I'm very interested. It's always been kind of like that in the whole built environment and the whole history of how things developed and where they are and why downtown is where it is a result of these like forces of capital sort of competing against each other. And these kind of successive kind of waves of what geographers call revanchism, where capital really wants access back into these areas. And I know the downtown east side is a national sort of conversation, but people I think forget why it happened, and it was a policy choice. It wasn't the sort of thing that just kind of like, oh, there's just this area. You know, it was a direct policy choice of containment by pushing people from surrounding areas like the West End, Yale Town, Fairview Slopes, and pushing everyone into that area and containing it. You know, in the West End's beautiful sort of high dense area, a lot of queer people live there. But I mean, there was traffic calming that was done there to prevent sex work, and sex work was pushed into the downtown east side. And, you know, there's just kind of, once you peel back the layers, there's just the, you can really see the inequality in the built form. And it's not just something that happened by accident. It's just this like successive decades of policy, you know, in the downtown east side. You know, if you look at the way we were talking about the downtown east side in the 50s, and the 40s, even, it's the exact same the way we're talking about it. It's very much classist in terms of, you know, alcohol was the thing that people, you know, we have to stop. And they actually froze like liquor licenses. And there's still to this day, there's no like new liquor licenses in the downtown east side, because that was the, you know, but it's not really about liquor. It's not, and, you know, it's not. They also use like syphilis as like a way to like to control the population. It's never really about those things. It's about you know, sort of controlling the working class and keeping people, you know, separate and poor. That's the way capital works. You know, you have to have, you know, these levels of poverty in order for to have these other levels of wealth, right? It's a really great question, because I could go probably on for hours in terms of how the city itself has sort of shaped my views of the world. It's a fascinating city in that regards, because it's because we're such a new city, and we are this bastion of colonialism, this kind of, we have this idea of this kind of frontier mentality. I did an essay just recently in school about Gastown, and there's all this kind of like really violent imagery in Gastown, like Blood Alley, and, you know, and they put up a statue of Gassy Jack, who was like a actual rapist, you know, and there's a restaurant called Peck and Paw and Labatoire, which is like you're in Montreal, you know, like it's a slaughterhouse, you know, and there's all this really like kind of violent imagery, and it's about this kind of like pioneering spirit. And really in lockstep with gentrification, how these two kind of these kind of ideas work. This, what was it called? I'm gonna blow it here, but I can't remember the term. Maybe I'll get back to you. But this kind of idea of like cultural colonialism, essentially, that cannibalizes kind of imagery of working class things. Like I'm sure you get this in Montreal too. You know, you get these restaurants that come in and they have these motifs of like, you know, pioneering with kind of, you know, rugged, you know, white man, essentially, like, and you know, coming in and it's just, yeah, it's just a really fascinating city. I'm sure there's stories for every city, but that's the short answer, believe it or not.
Yeah, no, I'm in Vancouver a lot for work, actually, in the downtown east side. I often think about how, you're right, it's a new city, so it's different than Montreal and Toronto, where like I kind of grew up, I guess. And very great salient points about the disparity. Like the minute you cross a street, the disparity in the world that changes. Mm. You're in this, like, you're at Sebastian the Seagull or whatever that coffee shop is, and then you like turn the corner and the world changes.
Mm-hmm.
In Vancouver, yeah. And that's a policy decision. That's a policy decision.
Yeah, absolutely.
To have people in those condos that are like $3,000, like that kind of, flat iron building, that are like $3,000 a month, versus like right around the corner, what people are living in, houses that get like rooming houses that get burned down because landlords are slumlords. And
Nelson the Seagull is the
Oh, Nelson the Seagull. The way I'm like Sebastian the Seagull. Yeah. Like right around that corner, the world changes. Like, that's in one city, two blocks.
And it's because like you said, it's this policy of Gastown is a protected area. It's like and Chinatown is this other protected area, and you have Hastings as this sort of like unprotected area. That's just this kind of like almost this knife into the city. It's very, it's the way it's set up is very weird, and it's because Vancouver, the landmass is constricted, you know, by the border, the mountains, the ocean. You have it. It is very visible, and it is a part of the reason why it is a national conversation, even though this is it's not unique to Vancouver, you know, but, you know, certainly the climate also plays a role. You do have more people outdoors, but because it's so visible, I think you have this conversation where you have the media is so in lockstep with capital in terms of vilifying it and constantly, you know, calling it a war zone or saying that. I mean, over the years, there's just been some disgusting rhetoric around it. And, I've written a couple articles about it, but just like kind of showing that rhetoric and show how it ties into the police lobby and you know, we have some of the highest budget per capita, you know, that we spend on the police. And it's the downtown east side is used as this, not only this as a target for that, but also as the reason why we need it. And it's this kind of thing that is constantly sort of romanticized and used. It's used as this moral stand-in.
That was Nashua Khan speaking with Vancouver City Councillor Sean Orr on Habibzi Please. Find new episodes at habibzipolice.substack.com or wherever you get your podcasts, and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Launching in October 2024, news criticism podcast The North State features journalist Scott Martin punching through the noise bi-weekly and tackling how news media frames issues, omits information, and pushes the status quo, like on this recent interview with independent journalist Jeremy Appel, unpacking the news of the week, including the story behind an apparently insurrectionist Canadian Armed Forces member's Facebook group.
The North State is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network.
Well, there's turmoil at the CBC. There's turmoil in the Canadian Armed Forces that has been going on for quite a bit of time that we need to talk about. How the reporting has not quite met the moment there. And finally, Carney has been talking with Trump about Canadian trade. A couple stories have trickled out, but really, why haven't we seen a huge focus on this? This is a lot to get through, and thankfully for this, I have independent reporter, and geez, I seem to see you everywhere. You're in Canada's National Observer, you're in the Taii. Jeremy Appel.
Great to be here, Scott, on the Catch Shortcuts.
Well, with that, it's time for the North State Breakdown. Travis Danraj, the now former host of Canada Tonight at CBC News, sent out a letter this morning, actually. I just saw this about an hour ago, which sent to me scrambling for this episode. He said in this letter, it was an email to CBC News employees, that he was, quote, forced to resign from CBC News. In the email, he says it was not a voluntary decision by himself and came as a result of trying to navigate a workplace culture defined by, quote, retaliation, exclusion, and psychological harm. Danraj spent the majority of the letter warning about CBC's contradiction between its stated values and its reality. I just want to quote this particular piece from it because I think it's probably the most salient. Quote, the erosion of trust in the CBC didn't happen overnight. It's the result of years of dysfunction at the highest levels where a small group of insiders on air and in management wields outsized influence and prioritizes spin over substance. Leadership clings to reputation while failing to confront the real reasons viewership is in freefall. Mickey Jurek, I hope I pronounced that correctly. If I did not, please correct me. Politics reporter for Politico reports that CBC's response is as follows. Quote, this morning, Travis Danraj, a unionized employee of CBC Radio Canada, who is currently on leave, sent internal notes making serious allegations. While we are limited in what we can say in response due to privacy and confidentiality considerations, CBC categorically rejects the accusations made about CBC News, our staff, and management. Jeremy, I think I said this to you maybe about 40 minutes before we were supposed to sit down and talk about this. This is a lot. What are your immediate thoughts about this whole situation that just came out?
Well, you know, it's interesting because it came across my feed on Blue Sky, as these things do. And I read his statement, and what I read into it was, here's a guy, a person of color, who has been put into a prominent hosting slot on the CBC, but it seems like he's being hamstrung and feels as if he is being, and he uses the word explicitly in his statement, tokenized, and that the higher-ups aren't actually willing to listen to him or hear his input on story ideas, right? He talks about systemic issues and editorial imbalance and how CBC uses inclusion as a branding tool, not a lived principle. Yeah, that's what I thought. But then I saw Brian Lilly's column, and
always makes you think, his columns, don't they?
Yeah, always. Not in the way he intended, of course. But he turned this into, oh, CBC loves diversity, just not diversity opinion, and is really playing up the angle that Dan Raj was maybe trying to push back against some liberal pieties and got shut down. Now, unless Brian Lilly knows something that we don't, that seems like he might be looking at this through ideologically tinted glasses. But I thought you noted quite astutely on Blue Sky that Dan Raj's statement really is like a Rorschach test. Like, it's very vague. He doesn't talk about anything specific. When I hear about systemic biases and prioritizing spin over substance, you know, in that he's not here to protect comfort, I think about a lot of issues I have at the CBC that I know we're going to discuss shortly. But, and I don't know if this was deliberate on this part, but he certainly left it open to interpretation.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure about the deliberateness of that as well, but I did find it interesting. You know, in Brian Lilly's column, he notes that Dan Raj had him on his show, and the way he frames it, he says, quote, appearances by people like me, not normally welcome at CBC HQ, didn't go over well either. And then he doesn't really cite any support for this. He just goes back to the letter. So it is a very much a question of, like, does he know something that he's trying to allude to? I don't think there's a lot of value in going down that, but I think it is interesting how this statement comes out, and at a time where trust in the CBC is pretty low for a lot of reasons, people like you and me, who clearly have very robust critiques of the way that the CBC has covered, say, Palestine, would agree with a lot of this. And I'm sure a lot of reporters who are people of color would agree with a lot of this, considering the experiences that they've had in Canadian newsrooms in general, if not the CBC specifically. And I did want to note that Brian Lilly, in his column, he said that he really focused on the diversity of opinion. So, Brian, if you're listening, could you please advocate for me to go on the CBC so I can talk about Marxism if you want the diversity of opinion so much?
Yeah, or like give me a Toronto Sun column.
Exactly. You know, we were all about diversity of opinion here. But yeah, I think it's very interesting, especially considering the CBC response. It seems like they still say that he's on leave and that he hasn't resigned. I mean, they didn't confirm or deny from the reporting I've seen, but it's interesting how they didn't say he still works here, or, you know, we didn't force him to resign or something like that. They just go, this reporter who is currently on leave. So first glance, it looks like this is something pretty huge, and it might be, but we really don't know that much about what's going on right now.
Right. I mean, this is like breaking news, right? Like, this happened this morning, so we don't know what the fallout's going to be, but it's certainly something to keep an eye on. One thing I would note that Nora Loretto noted on Blue Sky is that Dan Raj's predecessor, Janela Massa, also quit and now is doing independent journalism. And in her case, you know, it was quite clearly about not being able to say the truth about, the genocide in Palestine. Because that is, I mean, a critique. I mean, if you know any racialized people who are working in Canadian newsrooms, I mean, not all of them, of course, are of the same mind, but you will commonly hear the complaint that diversity is being used as a fig leaf to just continue the same old editorial policies that have existed for years, just with racialized people delivering the news in the way the white higher-ups want them to. So it's something worth considering, but again, we don't know that much.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's kind of important to tie in a lot of the CBC reporting that has happened lately, because people like Brian Lilly will say things like, you know, they don't allow a diversity of opinion. You know, they're all a bunch of liberals and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You're not special, Brian. I'm not a big fan of Rosie Martin either. But we're going to talk about this one story that got published there. And I'm sure you're aware of it because the contents of it was quite, I'm going to be charitable and say interesting. CBC decided that as part of its series on Canada Day, it would publish a first person column by someone who did not like Canada and wants Alberta to separate. This man, as he writes in his column quite proudly, he and his wife refused to get vaccinated for COVID, which made him mad. And then they joined the Coots blockade in Alberta. And I know we have a lot to talk about the content of this and the choice to push it, but I will remind listeners who may have forgotten, two protesters at the Coots blockade were convicted of mischief and possession of a weapon for dangerous purpose after police found weapons, ammo, and body armor near the blockade. And one of the men also was convicted of possessing a pipe bomb. Now, to be clear, this man and his wife were not involved in that aspect at all, but I want to give an idea of what the climate was like at the Coots blockade. So,
I mean, they just came down to show their support for the people who were arrested and convicted of those things that you mentioned.
And hug the RCMP, correct?
Yeah. No, it's, you know, whom amongst us? I mean, we've all been there. I mean, it's worth noting at the time, Premier Danielle Smith, who wasn't yet premier, was still a podcaster and vlogger, said that she hopes the Coots blockade win. You know, I mean, Mr.
Gord Larson? Gord Larson.
That's right. Of course, his name's Gord.
Well, he doesn't want to be Canadian anymore, so maybe we should take that name back.
Yeah, but he is very proud of Canada. It's just he didn't get his way, so now he wants to split, as one does. Again, whom amongst us, right? Mm-hmm. Gord is in great company, is my point.
And I think it's important that we talk about that company, because he writes in this piece, the convoy, you know, in Ottawa, quote, not one car was burned, not one shop looted. Now, again, to remind people, because there's a lot of things that happened there that, you know, I think he's technically right about this. But, you know, two men were charged with attempted arson around the time, although the police did say they dismissed a connection to the convoy, for whatever that's worth, from the police. And a soup kitchen was the target of harassment. There were Confederate and Nazi flags were being waved, multiple like posts about people they know being harassed. If I recall correctly, I know people in Ottawa, and there are still people who are regularly protesting for the convoy, like weekly or something like that. You know, take that with a grain of salt. I didn't do original reporting on this, but, you know, not one car burned, not one shop looted, Jeremy.
I mean, you don't even have to go that far to Ottawa. I mean, in Coots, as you noted, you know, people were convicted of fairly serious crimes and were accused of conspiring to murder a police officer, which, you know, for some reason didn't make it into Gord's article. So I get what he's trying to do. You know, it's not very clever. He's contrasting this peace-loving convoy that an Edmonton Journal contributor, I remember, compared to Woodstock, the original, not 99. Contrasting that with, you know, BLM protests or Palestine protests that got out of hand. I'm sure law enforcement might have played a role in that, but, you know, who's to say? And I guess now would be a good time to point out how I spent my Canada Day. I went to, because this is related, I went to the Whistle Stop Cafe, which you may remember as a cafe in rural central Alberta that refused to close down at the height of the pandemic. The owner was charged with a bunch of offenses and was actually acquitted because the courts determined that actually these COVID restrictions weren't being imposed by public health officials, as public health officials could do if they wanted, but were political decisions, right? And so those charges got dropped. But his establishment was host to a Alberta separatism rally on Canada Day, featuring really an all-star lineup of leading lights of the separatist movement and convoy crowd, like Maxime Bernier. Tamara Litch actually played a set with her band, who is like the leader of the convoy.
Oh, I'd kill to see that concert.
Yeah, I posted a video of it on Instagram. Instagram, she played Folsom Prison Blues, but changed the lyrics to make it about the convoy and her time behind bars.
I read your post about it. I didn't watch the video because I didn't want to die of cringe, but I did read about it.
It was good. Cameron Davies, who's the leader of the Republican Party of Alberta, which is sort of the leading avowedly separatist party, as opposed to the UCP that are just crypto separatists. And Christine Anderson, this German far-right politician, was the keynote speaker, who claimed she didn't even know that Alberta separatism was a thing when she signed up to be the keynote speaker at a separatist rally. And she's really a piece of work.
Whom amongst us, Jeremy?
Yeah, sometimes you just fly overseas to participate in an event and you don't know anything about it.
You know that thing where you go to an airport and you just buy the first ticket that comes available and you get the one that goes to rural Alberta so you can speak at an event? You know, like, we've all wanted to do it.
Yeah, that's right. You just fly into, you know, Red Deer's International Airport that exists,